Is that working? Yeah, hi. Hi, everyone. I'm Jennifer Higgy, co-editor of Freeze magazine. And it's a great pleasure to invite Fritz Haig and for him to accept coming today. And I've just got a little introduction about his work. Likening his complex practice to a system of crop rotation, Fritz Haig works between his architecture and design practice, though currently his preferred clients are animals, the happenings and gatherings of Sundown Salon, the ecology initiatives of Garden Lab, including Edible Estates, and other various combinations of building, designing, gardening, exhibiting, dancing, organizing, and talking. His first book, Edible Estates, Attack on the Front Lawn, was published by Metropolis Books and distributed by DAP earlier this year. As Bradley Horn wrote in the pages of Freeze, for architects, Haig is an artist. For artists, he's a landscape architect. And for the homeowners whose front lawns he wants to transform into vegetable gardens, he is an environmental activist. He has produced projects and exhibited work at countless museums and galleries around the world and has variously taught in architecture, design, and fine art programs at CalArts, Art Center, College of Design, Parsons, and the University of Southern California. In 2006, he initiated Sundown Schoolhouse, the self-organized educational environment originally based in his geodesic dome in Los Angeles. Fritz's talk today will explore populist projects, insular bohemia, activist art, passive entertainment, network communication, broadcast media, social strategies of isolation, and potential roles for today's artist in a fractured society. But I suspect he'll talk about a lot more than that too. Anyway, I'd like you all to welcome Fritz Haig.
Thanks so much. It's such an honor to be here. So when I received the invitation to do the talk, it was an opportunity to come up with some sort of new lecture, I suppose, about what I'm thinking about at the moment. So actually, before anything else, I came up with the title, and then what I'm talking about today is grown directly out of that title. So these words, something for everyone. So I just want to start off thinking about those words, and maybe you can run through in your heads all the possible meanings that that has in terms of survival, but also diversity and a variety of tastes, and a generosity, and maybe an extending beyond our safe disciplines, perhaps. But I really like this title as a way of looking at the work I've been doing to the last few years just through the filter of this one title. And also, I thought it would be a good title for a lecture to get people to come, because maybe everyone would think, like, oh, well, there's something for me in there, probably, if there's something for everyone's. So what I want to start with is this map, which is really appropriate now because we're on the eve of an election in the United States. And this is really the map. The ideas behind the map, I think, in some way, are what set me on the path to the work that I'm doing now. In the end of 2004, I had an extended period of time away from LA, where I've been for the last 8 years. I was in Australia. And I had just finished a lot of very complicated projects that had occupied me for a few years, and then I had this six-week emptiness that I set aside as a period to consider what I wanted to do with my work, as a really conscious moment to say, okay, what do I want to accomplish with the work that I'm doing? And not little things, but really big things, and I knew that coming out of that, I wouldn't maybe even know what I was going to do, which I didn't. I had no idea what I was going to do after those 6 weeks. But this election happened, this map happened. In the United States, we supposedly had these culture wars, and we supposedly were split in two between red and blue, the cultural elite of the coasts and the interior red zone of the conservative Bible thumpers, I suppose. I don't know. But anyway, there are all these divisions happening. And I came back from that trip with only one thought or impulse, and that was the desire to make work that was for everyone, that was for the whole country. And I had no idea how I was going to achieve that, but my first thought went symbolically, just as a symbolic act, to do something in the geographic center of the country, which is Kansas. So basically the only thought in my head was, okay, do something in Kansas, but I didn't really know what I was supposed to do. Like maybe I was going to do maybe some reenactment of the pioneers headed west and making sod houses and geodesic domes in the prairie or something. Like, I don't know. Anyway, so that moment and that decision really started me on a few of the projects that I'll be showing you today. And of course, now being on the cusp of another election, I think it's really an interesting moment to check back in with, for me, I guess, with the work that I've been doing and thinking about how this map will be evolving in the next election. And also, the other big impulse that grew out of this extending out in addressing a broader audience was also feeling really disillusioned with the contemporary art and architecture and design worlds that I feel a part of, which I think, in the spirit of the title of the lecture, Something for Everything, I think we need a lot of different models and acceptable ways to practice in our different disciplines. I think sometimes it requires an insular discourse among a small group of people, and sometimes, and I think today especially, we have an urgent need to step out of our disciplines and to step out of our immediate peers and have a conversation and take with a broader audience and take maybe what has been learned in that small world of a particular discipline and take it out to a broader world. Anyway, so this somehow led me to the front lawn when I arrived in Kansas to do a project. This is Los Angeles. This is New Jersey. These are radically different environments. We get maybe 7 inches of rain a year in LA, something like that. New Jersey gets a lot more. We've got mountains and, you know, radically different places, and yet we treat them the same. So I focused on the space of this front lawn as being this amazing space of opportunity that we all collectively as Americans and Australians and people in some other countries have bought into, this idea of this ornamental space upon which we present our homes. And it was originally sold to us in America as a democratic space that we were all collectively tending together. And any lapse in tending that space is a moral lapse. Like, you're a bad person if you don't mow your lawn. And if you grow up in American suburbs, you know that the tending of the lawn is this amazing ritual that happens on the weekends where you hear all the lawnmowers going, and it sounds like democracy. It sounds like, you know, everyone's out there doing their part to keep down the wildness and to maintain the continuity and the control, because lawns prevent eccentricity. They keep down local particularities that we find that we are uncomfortable with. Here's the space that I chose to deal with, really. This space that no one feels comfortable in. The person on the street doesn't feel comfortable stepping here. The people in this home certainly don't feel comfortable going out there and doing much. We have this security, like, surveillance bay window to make sure nobody goes here. And it's this highly controlled space that has no function, and yet we have 30 million acres of lawn in the United States. It's the largest crop. So here, after the very general thought of wanting to do something for everyone, it was very important for me to find a very particular physical space that we all shared. And I didn't. I'm explaining this all in retrospect because I wasn't conscious of this when I was doing it. But I think it was important to find a space that we all bought into. This cuts across all geographic, economic, political, religious boundaries in our country. Like, everyone's out there taking care of this space. And I took this picture in front of a house with an Amnesty International sign in the window, and it shows you how easily we sit with these two opposite ideas. Like, this land that you dump pesticides on, you dump water on, it immediately toxifies the water, goes into our drinking water supply. Then we mow it with these two-stroke mowers that pollute. So it's this polluting, wasteful space that we don't even enter into. So my interest was reconsidering this space and immodestly reconsidering one of them by, as making a prototype, I'm then reconsidering all of them and suddenly proposing in a whole new way of living, possibly. So here, for example, is what happened in the 40s, late 40s in Lakewood, California. Entire city made for 70,000 made in just like 3 or 4 years. And this might remind you of Le Corbusier's Radiant City. And you understand this was, you know, Le Corbusier did not manage to make a lot of Radiant City, global Radiant Cities, which was his dream, and they failed all over the place. But you understand when you really look at how we're living today that, in fact, we're living in his Radiant Cities everywhere. And I love his quote, "The cities will be part of the country." That's great. I mean, that's my favorite. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but that idea is that our cities will be part of the country. I mean, wow, really? I mean, that possibility for grafting these two things on top of each other without either losing anything is the great dream and hope of the suburbs. I shall live 30 miles from my office in one direction under a pine tree. Great. Like, who doesn't want that? And my secretary will live 30 miles the other way from it, too. In the other direction, under another pine tree. We shall both have our own car. We shall use up tires, wear out road surfaces and gears, consume oil and gasoline, all of which will necessitate a great deal of work, enough for all. So it's this beautiful manifesto about something for everyone, you know? And it shows the best intentions, I suppose. But, of course, you read that for us today, and it's like a nightmare, right? Like, the nightmare was planned. It was organized, and it was played out in a very thoughtful, logical, well-intentioned way. And I think it shows what happens when grand, utopian, like top-down models like this, what happens sometimes when, you live in them. So here's our basically American dream, and this is what we're exporting globally in a way. So I'm really interested in how we're living. I'm interested in how we're all living. And I'm interested in going to those strategic moments, almost like pressure points or acupuncture, or those very particular moments where if you press on something or make a very strategic move, it somehow ripples and affects the way we're living at a really broad level. So if you look at this as a very common situation, I'm focused on this project very narrowly on this little bit of grass right here between the house and the street and the possible things that can happen there. But I'm really interested in all the levels of isolation that have been engineered here. If you think top to bottom, this entire situation, this entire way of living has been engineered to isolate one activity from another, one person from another. Living and working and eating where food is coming from is remote from where we're actually living. So this is a picture I took flying over the desert southwest where our crops are grown in the United States. And this idea that our food is grown in these really remote locations and then trucked to us. So I'm really interested in making some evidence within our cities of what makes those cities possible. Right now we're living in cities where all evidence of our survival in these cities is invisible or hidden. In the case of our food, it's shipped remotely from the other side of the planet sometimes. In terms of waste, you throw it away, but there is no way. It goes somewhere that we don't see. So unlike a small village a few hundred years ago, you were very aware of where things were coming from and where your crop was going. But today, we live in this wonderful bubble where stuff comes out of nowhere and our crop goes somewhere we don't know, and it's all great until we reach limits, and then we start to understand what happens. So also, I guess the other thing I didn't mention, a lot of everything that I'll be kind of talking about is kind of through the lens of the Western United States as symbolizing limits in some way, and the idea of manifest destiny, which I'll talk about too, but how all of these things have played out in the American West where I've been living. So here we can see early shelter in North America, always one room, teepee, wigwam, And all activities would happen in this one space. And you can see how it's identified here, all the things that could happen there. And then you go forward a little bit, and there's been a division made between the parlor and the kitchen and the hall, and then upstairs where you would sleep, and then another division. So sequentially over time, we slowly felt the need to divide things. And as you're seeing this play this out here in the home, it's also happening in our cities. And of course today, where it's like exponential fracturing, right? Like every minuscule activity now needs its separate cell and container within which it can happen. And then you go outside, and here's something for everyone. Like, this is what we have in LA. You can drive down any street, in residential street in Los Angeles, and you have this wonderful, like, global style survey of the last few hundred years, and everyone gets to enjoy their fantasy of who they are. And you can see this significance of really the American dream of everyone occupying their own isolated home, surrounded by a lawn, with this very public face. And the lawn is officially private, but in fact it's quite public, because what you do there has great effect on everyone around you. And what you do there says how you feel about your neighbors, and it says who you think you are and what kind of face you're going to present to the world. So this is a picture of a very typical home, fancy developer home I took in New Jersey. And then we go back to the English estate, where the front lawn was really born, and you can see how little has changed, like, you know, from that. So the English estate is really where we see the birth of the front lawn. And here is the owner of this home demonstrating their great wealth by saying, I am so rich that I can take this otherwise valuable farmland and just use it as this ornamental space to present my amazing home. And then I'm going to hide the plants that produce food. So it's the beginning of this fracture that happens, saying productive food gardens are ugly and meant to be hidden. And the only thing that's proper to be presented to the public are sterile ornamentals. And if you go back further, of course, that isn't the case. We see beautiful evidence of like French kitchen gardens and monastic courtyard gardens that also produce food. If we step forward a bit in London, we'll see Victory Gardens here and in the States. And this is this is my favorite Victory Garden ever, created in a bomb crater. And you can see this juxtaposition of all of these things happening on top of each other. So in America, during the wars, there was a really extreme effort to get Americans to grow some percentage of their own food. And it was quite successful. 80% of Americans were growing some amount of their own food at that time. Immediately after the war, that dried up. And what we have with that is the last time there was a real oral tradition passed down from one generation to the next in one particular place about how to grow food. And living in LA, I've been gardening for years now, but if you put me in New Jersey, I'm really not going to know what to do so much. It's such a localized thing. So I'm really interested in these broad, general, kind of global thoughts and ideas that in terms of how we're occupying the planet, but then how they're actually manifested are super local as much as possible. So the Edible Estates Project I began in 2005, and there's been 7 editions so far. And my initial goal was to divide the country into a grid of 9 squares and do one regional prototype garden in each square to demonstrate what is possible. To remove a family's front lawn, replace it entirely with an edible garden that I've designed with them, and then tell the story of that garden in as many ways as possible and broadcast these stories. So my hope is to do 9 in the United States. The first one was in Salina, Kansas, which is the geographic center of the United States. So this was my symbolic project that I mentioned finally took place in this front lawn in Kansas. And over a weekend, I worked with the family and some volunteers, and we made this garden, and 6 weeks later, the okra was already blocking the house's view from the street. So this garden was made, commissioned by a local art organization called the Salina Art Center, and then in the space, it was presented with videos and books and things like that, and then a brochure was printed so that people could find out what was going on there. And I guess I'm also interested in how how, you know, all these gardens have been commissioned mostly by art institutions and museums. And I've become really interested in how the art world, museums, can be used as invisible staging grounds for work that then goes out into society without people even having to know where it came from. Like, I hold on to the identification of this project as art very loosely. So when it's written about in the mainstream press, they rarely mention the museum sometimes or that it was commissioned by an art organization. And that's fine. Like, when someone reads in their newspaper that a garden is art, like, then a whole other chain of conversations happens that maybe isn't particularly productive or that I don't really care about so much. So I'm fine if it goes out just as a garden, and then people can discuss it how they want. And gardeners think of it one way, a homeowner thinks about it as another. So these brochures kind of tell you how to do this yourself, like a planting calendar for that region. This was the next family in Lakewood, California. That picture I showed you before of Lakewood from above, this is Lakewood today, very typical home. It took me about 4 months to find this family, a computer programmer and his two kids. And they were perfect. Like, I look for families that are active gardeners, that also live in kind of streets of endless lawn where doing this project will be a radical intervention in some way. And also, they had been keeping a blog about the egg production of their hens in their backyard. And I thought, great, like, here are people that want to tell the story of their gardening and chicken keeping experiences. And that's, I want these people to tell their stories. So his entire blog from the first season of this garden is in the Edible Estates book. And all of the people that I work with are meant to be kind of like local spokespeople in a way, so that we plant the garden, I leave, it's their garden then, and they kind of take over. And there's our Edible Estate sign. This was at the first three gardens, and then at the fourth one, it got stolen. I think the neighbor hated the garden and took it or something. So here's the garden from above. So they're very strategically positioned so that it's this kind of really great contrast with everything around it. So when this garden was completed and filled in, you would drive down the street of these endless lawns and not a sign of wildlife anywhere. And then in the distance, before you even saw the garden, sometimes you would just see this little cloud of like bees and birds and butterflies and this little like kind of urban wildlife preserve. This was the next family in New Jersey. These recently moved from the East Village, kind of punk couple covered in tattoos. So they had no problem pissing off their neighbors, making the garden. So, and they did piss off their neighbors. Like, the neighbor on the right is still upset about this. She can't stand it. But the homeowner here, this older German couple, I think they love it. So these gardens are meant to be, there's a lot of different kinds of designs. So each garden represents a different possibility. This one's planted all with strawberries around the perimeter. You can see from above, like right after we planted it, how bare it looks. This one's in London. I think we'll be there on Sunday from 11 to 1 doing a planting with the residents. But this was commissioned by Tate Modern last year. And the inspiration is working with Bankside Open Spaces Trust, who's still managing it. And then the owners or the residents of these different council housing estates. And I wanted to create a design that was uniquely appreciated from above. So I created this kind of swirly design that is somehow reminiscent of these royal parks with all the curvy raised flower beds and things. But instead, this one was, instead of being ornamental, this productive garden that people are communally eating from and tending. So it's not a community garden with private plots. And it's managed to work out somehow. Like, people, I was there a random afternoon a month or two ago, and there were just families there hanging out, tending the food with their kids. And this was the installation in the Turbine Hall with this huge table, resource center of books, a video about the project. So with each garden, I try to broadcast the story of it in as many ways as possible, in the gallery, in printed material online with videos. This was in Austin, Texas, an apartment complex, working with the local residents there. We had a series of workshops at that one. So the garden is the focus, but there's all these ancillary activities. So you can't really point to one center of the project. There's all these different parts to it. And here's the most recent one in Baltimore, Maryland, for the Ridgelys. And this garden was just planted, I guess, at the beginning of this year. You can see it from above. So in the book that just came out, it's a documentation that tells the story of these different gardeners and with stories by the actual garden owners that I work with. And the challenge for me was creating a book that could be viewed by all of these different people so they could all be looking at it and they wouldn't know the other person was reading it. So artists and maybe art world people would read it because the project has obviously been situated in the art world. But then gardeners and homeowners and radical environmentalists and foodies, you know, like they're all interested in the book, but they don't know that the other people are looking at it. And that's the problem with something for everyone, right? Like you can never please everyone. And it's impossible. And I kind of love the idea of going about something that you believe in that you know is impossible, but you're going to at least go as far as you can. So the goal of this book was to satisfy all these disparate readers. And I think a lot of people like the book. But this, you'll see from this review on Amazon.com that this was very common, like gardeners complaining that the gardens are too ugly. Or art people complaining like, well, you never really talk about the art stuff, you know? So everyone kind of wanted more. But I'm really, one thing that's important to me with the gardens is they're meant to be kind of a little ratty and ugly and real. Like I hate aspirational design magazines that you're supposed to strive for this impossible perfection and you're supposed to buy things to be able to achieve this perfection that you're striving for. And I think it's going to undo us, honestly, this part of our society. So I really want the gardens to be as real as possible. So if gardeners complain that they're ugly or they're, you know, whatever, that's fine. Like part of the point is to put out something and be like, you know, maybe you can do better or something, you know? So this takes me to the Sierra Nevadas, and to this idea of manifest destiny. As we Americans began to conquer our continent slowly from one end to the other, there was this idea of manifest destiny. That is, we had an entitlement to the whole continent all the way to the Pacific, and that it was ours, and that it was this bounty and this beauty and this abundance that was endless and that was permanent, and that was God-given, and it was our right. And you had painters and artists going to the West and sending stories back in the form of these massive paintings that you could put yourself in front of and imagine being there. And it was the story of our future and our dreams and our entitled right as United States citizens to claim this land. And it represents infinite prosperity, no limits, but also something to be conquered, because it also represents the West is, of course, wild and presents all these barriers to occupation that the East didn't. So the story of the West is always one of domination and never one of limits, because there never seemed to be limits there. It always seemed to be a bear is going to eat me. It's really hard to grow food here because we don't get much water. You know, there's all these challenges. So much of the West is about the challenges of survival. There's this wonderful book called Tending the Wild that really was a revelation to me. It's this very obscure academic book that this researcher spent like 20 years putting together. But basically it tells the story of local Southern California tribes and their lives in these particular places before European settlers arrived. Now, European settlers arrived and saw this, and they saw these native peoples living there, and they thought, here are these lazy, lazy people just eating high off the land, and they've got it made. They're basically don't know what they're doing. They're just kind of lolling around in this kind of Eden and just kind of living high off the hog. And these settlers or colonists arrived without any idea of what was going on. What's really going on is this is entirely a tended garden. This entire landscape of California, Southern California in particular, that we're looking at, this is a massive, massive tended garden. They are strategically going in and trimming things, planting things, straightening things, setting strategic fires. This is a managed landscape that they're eating from. So they're not living a high life. They're working and they're tending things. But when the settlers arrived, they didn't see any of that. All they saw were happy people, like living in the middle of this landscape where there's not rows of crops or anything like that. So this is Tejon Ranch. you know, whatever, 100, 150 years ago. And this is it today. It's the largest piece of private property in California, 270,000 acres, most of which is now going to be turned over as a reserve, but there's been a lot of controversy of this becoming developments. And, of course, this switching from a mode of total survival, like I think we're going to die if we don't figure out how to grow food, to today, in very short time, how can we occupy this land without destroying all of us and everything around us? Like, it's breathtaking how quickly we've gone to, are we going to survive this winter, to, are we going to decimate everything around us, you know? And it's happened so quickly we don't even know how to deal with it. So these issues of development and occupation of the land in Southern California are very heated and complicated, and 270,000 acres come up is what are we going to do with them? It's very complicated issues, and it gets at issues of what happens when you reach that limit of the Pacific Coast. The Pacific Ocean, we've reached the limits, and now what? All that land we're entitled to, we've dominated, we're surviving, we're thriving, and now we're more powerful than we thought we were, maybe. And it's amazing to think just 100 years back how different that story was. And of course, it's one of concentration of peoples, too. Now, compare that to this week with this economic collapse, and think about how directly in contact you are with your collapse here. Hailstorm, everything's wiped out, you're not eating tomorrow. With this, we read about it online, and then it's like, oh, okay, things are collapsing, and then there's this kind of very abstract situation that plays out where we're all wondering how it's going to actually fall out. So I think we're all wondering that today, right? Like, are you strategically going through your mind, like, where is this going to fall apart for me? You know, like, at what point does this become uncomfortable, or where does this play out? So it's so abstract. And also, it also gets at how we get our news, which is not orally. It's, you know, through newspapers online. And what I'm specifically interested in, too, is how we get our news differently. We have a situation today where we all can go to get our news from the place that we agree with. We get news from places that reinforce what we already believe to be true. And there's this book recently out called The Great Sort, I believe, that talks about this phenomena today of people moving towards people of like mind, and it's reinforcing people's beliefs and leading to a certain extremism that never happened before when you live down the street of someone with radically different points of view. So what happens when, in the press, in the media, that happens, not even in neighborhoods, so that points of view are reinforced. So, of course, the New York Times, for a lot of Americans, it's just like, it's the news. For a lot of Republicans, if you say the New York Times at a Sarah Palin rally, everyone boos, and it's like violence is going to break out because the New York Times is evil. And then if you go to Fox News, of course, Barack Obama is saying because of Fox News, he's down a few points that he would be otherwise, because Fox News is this radical right media source. So it's very interesting to think about how just the way those stories are told then either reinforce what we already believe and maybe prevent us from looking at the whole story. So to go back to Something for Everyone, I want to watch Fox News. I want to see what they're talking about. I want to talk to people that have different points of view. Like, I want, part of the byproduct of doing these lawns in different places is meeting people that I otherwise wouldn't, and extending outside of this safe, maybe New York and LA cultural circles that can be very important to frame yourself and to understand yourself and to maybe give some momentum to whatever it is you believe in. But then I think it's equally important maybe to step outside of that. Which leads me to this other great Andy Warhol quote. I don't know if I'll read the whole thing, but What's great about this country is that America started the tradition where the richest consumers buy essentially the same things as the poorest. You can be watching TV and see Coca-Cola, and you know that the president drinks Coca-Cola. Liz Taylor drinks Coca-Cola, and just think, you can drink Coca-Cola too. A Coke is a Coke no matter how much money you get. You can't get a better Coke than the one the bum on the corner is drinking. All the Cokes are the same, and all the Cokes are good. Liz Taylor knows it, the president knows it, and the bum knows it, and you know it. And it's so brilliant, and Andy Warhol is such a genius for identifying that, for understanding the simultaneous simplicity of that thought, but the infinite complexity of that and how it would play itself out in our society today. And I think you could even make the argument that we are in some ways moving further towards that in a more extreme way you could ever imagine, but away from it in ways that I explained between New York Times and Fox News that are confusing in a way. How we've simultaneously been fractured and pulled together in ways that are creating what in America we have are calling these culture wars, I suppose. So if you walk down the common America grocery store soda aisle today, okay, this is a grocery store where you buy food, and this is the soda aisle, and it's breathtaking. I think sometimes Europeans come to America and they go down with these massive shopping carts that are like this big, and you go down this aisle, and it's kind of breathtaking. I want to see European tourists taking pictures of the soda pop aisle in the grocery stores. So this brings me to Sarah Palin, who I think is this like amazing phenomena, and I love it in comparison to this picture. I guess this picture and this picture, and then this picture, and this family at the edge, right? You can't get farther on the edge than Alaska. And I was just there last week, or a week and a half ago, and you feel like this is the western limit, right? But they haven't reached that we're destroying everything situation. There's so few people there. And there's still bears wandering around. So they're still in survival mode. So they're all about drilling. But, you know, the people that I met there, they split into two camps, either people that were horrified and embarrassed, or really proud, and there was nobody in between, which kind of reinforced that kind of bifurcation that I was talking about, I guess. And, you know, here, this was my one little walk to the glacier, and I saw a grizzly bear walking towards me. Like, if we hadn't turned around, that bear would have probably eaten me, because it's October and it's time to fatten up to hibernate. So what's the capital of Alaska? I forget where I was. Juneau. Just a little 10-minute drive outside of Juneau, there's grizzly bears wandering around that could eat you. And of course, we don't. That's one of the few situations on the planet where we have that immediate sense of being imperiled in this way. Here's moose walking down. They had 6 inches of snow last week. And we were driving down a suburban street, and there's a moose. And that's very common. They don't even look twice when the moose walks down the street. So that leads me to a good segue into the Animal Estates Project, which is the other project I wanted to talk to you about that I've been working on this year, which is basically making homes for animals in cities. Originally, I thought of it as this architecture project where my clients are animals instead of people. And thinking specifically about urban wildlife, animals that lived in cities before we got there, and thinking about strategically how we want to welcome them back. So these are the different additions this year. First one was in New York. And this is an aerial view of Manhattan on the day that Henry Hudson arrived, September 10th, 1609. So for this project, for the Whitney Biennial, I work with a local landscape ecologist who's been doing this intense research on Manhattan and what it looked like on September 10th at 2 p.m. in the afternoon at 1609. And he's reconstructed it, all the insects, all the plants, where the rivers were, where the rock outcroppings were, and he can take a picture anywhere in the island showing you what that looked like. So I work with him to kind of research a list of 12 animals that used to live at the corner of 75th and Madison right here. And he could tell me very specifically, beavers used to be there. So based on his research, and this kind of tells the story of what this was like, he knows the trees that were there, what was the understory, what was going on. So based on that, I developed a list of 12 animals that I would build homes for them to return. So here's the corner of 75th and Madison today, Marcel Breuer's Whitney Museum. So I had some flags to celebrate our model homes, animal estate model homes. And then this is the house for the barn owl. This is the bald eagle, flying squirrel nest box. So it's a very modest sort of project on the surface, and it was really made to be experienced by people on the street. So it's not made for the ticket buyers. It's really made for the people just wandering past that weren't even intending to have a Whitney Museum experience even. Oh, and I also thought the barn owl box looked a little bit like the Whitney, like a mini Whitney for the owl there. So all around the museum, there's this like moat, and I was originally thinking of that as this very zoo-like space. So I made these bronze plaques that would tell the story of these 12 animals and identify their homes. So these are for the purple martins, bobcats down there. This is the eagle's nest. And then these plaques would tell the story, and then when you go down, this was the beaver pond, kind of this minimalist, brutalist Marcel Breuer beaver pond and lodge, in a way. These are the purple martin homes. They live in these gourds. Mason bees will nest in these little 3/8-inch diameter holes. Now, on the surface, it would appear like this was the centerpiece of the project, but actually the most complicated part of the project was this intense 12-week programming that happened during it. Every week, I invited a different person to do a guided estate tour about one of the animals, which involved anything from a local turtle expert to bringing in turtles, to a friend who's a folk singer who wrote songs about the flying squirrel and performed them in the cafe. So this is Sarah Best, the restaurant down at the Whitney, and it's a lot of ladies who lunch kind of on the weekdays who weren't really ready for folk music about flying squirrels, except for this woman here who is actually Mary Tyler Moore, who happened to be there that day. And she was thrilled. Like, she was the one woman who was into it. And by the way, she's the activist who saved the hawks nesting on her co-op on Fifth Avenue, if you've heard about that. It's on the cover of the New York Post for years. But so I was so thrilled to see Mary Tyler Moore in the house when the folk singer was there. And I don't know if Kate Hardy's here. I know she's in town. But Kate Hardy's this wonderful performance artist in New York who I invited to do one of the weeks, and she came as the bobcat. So she actually came as the bobcat, kicked off the Animal Estates reality show to do her final elimination speech, and she had a press conference, and she kind of came in and really had this very formal press conference downstairs with video cameras and everything. And it was so wonderful to have kids, a lot of the kids, raising their hands and asking real questions, because she was like, yeah, it was really hard to be here for these 12 weeks, and the bobcat and the beaver were having this really big affair, and it was really uncomfortable for us, and, you know, the eagle could fly away, so he had it good, but we were stuck here, and I'm, you know. So we had these little kids like, you know, bobcat, what was it like to be at the top of the food chain? And, you know, Kate was like, oh, well, you know, I couldn't eat the other contestants. It was in my contract, so I had to eat the rats and Sarah Beth's or whatever. But I really like, with this project, using these animal homes and the story of these animals that used to live on this exact piece of geography, and to walk in that same piece of land and think of that story as of these animals here before, and then have that story told in as many ways as possible. And also, with these projects, there's a tendency to collapse under the weight of seriousness and environmental goodness, which I'm not interested in. I'm interested in stories revealing stories. So I think it's important, you know, something for everyone. So, so conveniently cast this male model to pose as all the animals. I invited 12 dancers who you saw in the opening video to write scores of movement inspired by each one of the 12 animals. And every week they moved through the museum, one of them at a time, performing all 12 animals. So they wrote a score. And then every animal of the Animal Estates project has a postcard that you can buy at the museum. In this case, the postcard was with the written score of the movement of the animal. So finger tips become tips of feather dipping into water. They drag around front asymmetrical elbows. So there are these really beautiful kind of scores written that you could take home and perform yourself at home. And then, of course, when it came to casting, I have a friend who shoots for Selected Boy periodicals, who helped cast this male model. So we had this model running around the Whitney Museum on the day that it was closed, taking these pictures of him in all of these poses. This is the possum when it plays dead. And, you know, something for everyone, because I have a huge gay fan base who was loving these postcards at the museum, who did not care about anything else. They were just like, bought all 12 postcards, have them hanging up at home. And I think that's important. So here for one of the performances, these are the Mud Turtles in the bookstore for that series, or the Bobcat in the lobby. And it was important that these performances not be performances. They were kind of ceremonial activities that would happen very quietly, one person moving through and acting them out. And if you knew they were happening, you could follow them, but most people didn't. And the animals were performed at the strata at which they used to live there. So the eagle was on the top, the beaver was on the bottom, so you could kind of work your way down. And then for one day in the armory, all 12 dancers performed all 12 animals together. Everyone was in a circle. And then we kind of split up and had kind of workshops where everyone could learn all the scores of movement. That was the eagle movement. In the Netherlands, which I just finished at Costco, all these great people are here who've worked on some of these projects, like Annie's here, who worked on this in the Netherlands. In the Netherlands, I thought it was going to be about these five animals I identified, but I found the most amazing animal experts there. So these five animal experts, the project's about them. It's not really about the animals in a way. There's portraits of them in the gallery. We made a video documentary about them. In this case, Tanika was the common swift expert, and she's been placing these homes for swifts around her neighborhood. And it gave a really, I don't know, she talked about these homes in the Netherlands hundreds of years old that have all these holes in them that the swifts used to nest in. And one by one, as the holy perforated buildings are destroyed and the new buildings are pulled up, these modern buildings have no cavities for the animals to go in. So this idea of porous architecture really got me excited. But as a stopgap measure, these homes serve that purpose. So for these postcards, there's instructions on how to make your own animal estate. In this case, a very modest pond in the backyard. This is the installation at Costco Projects. With a tent, like screening room for the video, the little turtle pond. And then every Animal Estates project has a traveling urban wildlife repository. So each city adds to it with local information on urban wildlife, books that are collected, and then that all is sent to the next city that it goes to. So it's growing like this snowball. So each city then includes material from the previous city. So that material's on display. And then there's workshops and like how to make your own backyard pond, for example. In Portland, this was just a few, well, I guess last month, in talking to local experts, I got really excited about the snag, which is in the Pacific Northwest, the dead tree. Up to 40% of urban wildlife in the Pacific Northwest depend upon dead trees to live in. And I think every city I go to, I just go with this very general thought of living with animals. Or what if we welcomed animals back? But then based on tours and meetings and meeting people, then the project becomes very localized and very specific to that place. So in this case, the dead tree really made me excited about this idea of death in the landscape and how uncomfortable we are with it. In human-managed landscapes, dead trees are removed as if they're useless detritus or something, when in fact, there's more life supported by a dead tree than a living tree. And actually, a dead tree serves this profound function that on the surface to us life-obsessed humans, is lost in us, really. So this dead tree then became the inspiration for the snag that I designed. So think of this as like luxury multi-unit residential tower for seven native Pacific Northwest animal species. So I selected seven animals and then kind of work with these local experts as consultants that were representing their clients, these animals. So for example, the bat lady told me like, okay, these bats, they need warmth up here because we're kind of cool. So they'll go under these louvers painted black facing south that will absorb the sun. The snake will sun himself on these rocks on the south side and then go into the hibernaculum. These are for the beetles. This little magenta tube is for the bees that will go in there. This is the traveling animal estates headquarters, which goes with all the materials. So then based on that and my design for this snag, I made this challenge to the city of Portland, which I don't know if you guys know Portland. It's this really progressive city. They pride themselves on being very radically progressive environmentalists. So I wanted to engage with that somehow. So we created this poster, this that was distributed in town, talking about the snag that I designed, and then challenging other residents in Portland to build their own. So a lot of local art colleges assigned it to their students. Like hundreds of third graders came through and did drawings of their snags. Some people built them on their properties, and then kind of were documenting those, and that goes into the repository that travels. And then in San Francisco, this is the headquarters there at SF MoMA, I was really excited about what was already happening in town. So that project was more about four animals that people are making amazing homes for already, and more and telling the story. So this is the best one. Pier 39 used to have boats, but like 10 or 15 years ago, the sea lions arrived, and they just took them over. And they sank them, and boats couldn't go there anymore. It was this great protected harbor. So Pier 39 said, okay, we can't get rid of them, so we'll just design homes for them. So they specially engineered these new floats for the sea lions. And now Pier 39 it's like boats, 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 Pier 39, sea lions, and then boats, boats, boats. And so these are engineered to support all their weight, like hundreds of them at a time will be on one of these. So I love... So sometimes I'm not making the animal estate. Sometimes I'm just pointing to something that's already in town and saying, oh, that's an animal estate. So let's tell that story and present it in different ways. This is another great one, which is the Slender Salamander Estate, which is just a board of wood that you throw in your backyard, and they live underneath. And the salamander expert came telling the story of those. So part of the SF MoMA project was having this like four weekends of activities where I invited fashion designers, writers, dancers to do different projects. So in this case, this group, Feral Child, designed hoodies, salamander hoodies that kids would make and then have a photo shoot in a fake forest as the salamander, or writing workshops. Or this parade that led to a dance for animal movements by Anna Halperin's Sea Ranch Collective. Anna Halperin is someone I just was turned on to a few years ago, but she epitomizes like everything that I think is beautiful about West Coast artists. She's in her 80s now. She's a dancer. She's been in the Bay Area for decades. In 1967, she did this project called Blank Placard. But she was a dancer that made this conscious decision not to go to New York, the dance capital, but to go to Northern California, Marin County, out in the woods. Her husband, Lawrence Halperin, built her a dance platform. And her whole practice is about non-professionalism. It's about looking at the reality of the world we're living in and responding to it in very direct ways. So her work, it's not choreography that's performed by other people in theaters. It's activities that happen in public space. This was another performance called Circle the Earth. So she works with non-dancers, just people from the street. So it's not about any precise movements. It's about people gathering together, taking back certain public spaces of the city. Ant Farm, there are these other heroes of mine, and it turns out Chip Lord, who's one of the founders of Ant Farm, studied under Anna Halperin for a short period. He's also from the Bay Area. And similarly, I don't know, Ant Farm, there are these other heroes of mine who trained formally as architects but then went on for about 10 years through their collaborative making these kind of radical projects. For example, this mobile inflatable environment that they would travel around the country with. Or one of my favorite, Media Burn. And to me, this Media Burn project was a really important precedent, I realized, for edible estates. It turns out this event happened 30 years to the day before I planted edible estates. It's like 30-year anniversary. I realized that when I was talking to Chip Lord. But this idea of creating this very ambitious project that was inserted into the very center of society there, they made this like press kit and media announcement. So it was mostly press that was there. They tricked out this car. They reenacted JFK's, or they had JFK give the speech there. And then, of course, driving into these TVs. So I'm thinking about the West Coast, and I'm thinking about, like, since I've been in the West Coast for the last 8 years, that's where I've found all my kind of richest inspiration. As I've kind of been developing my work, and one by one, I start to find precedents of who's gone before me. It's people that have been on the West Coast at some point. And today in Los Angeles, on the East Side where I live, there's this wonderful community of people kind of off the radar a little bit. I think we've had this really wonderful opportunity to be together outside of any real commercial activity or any real media interest in a way. So there were years where this kind of group of friends were making work, being inspired by what other people were doing, and also a real sense of camaraderie and not terribly competitive in a way. I think Journal of Aesthetics and Protest is one part of this. They publish a journal, but they also produce activities a lot of times in places like a parking lot of a grocery store, places that we typically, in LA, this is our landscape. Like, we've got these great parking lots. And I love the idea that, well, I guess when I first moved to LA from New York, one of the first weeks, they said, we're having our birthday party. And it was in Vaughn's parking lot. Like, that's where, just have your birthday parties there. And I like that idea of reclaiming these spaces that otherwise have zero value when they're not being used for other purposes. Another great one is Machine Project in Echo Park. And this is a space that's impossible to identify and classify. And I think in terms of something for everyone, it epitomizes this. Like, you could not classify anything there as being necessarily art, but you have to call it that because there's nothing else that we can call it. But there's sewing workshops there, there's presentations of projects, there's performances, it's a community center. It's this place that everyone that lives around there goes religiously to all the events. They have this very warm place in their heart for this place because it feels very much a part of your life there. It's not something that's imposed upon you. It's not something that's... also, the person behind it, Mark Allen, it's a very personalized space, so it feels very welcoming. This, for example, was a project called Building Rome in a Day, which was very common for the kind of projects they'll do. So it involved a communal activity of everyone building Rome for 24 hours. So literally, the space was full of people for 24 hours building Rome out of whatever junk they could find. And then they sacked... Well, here it is completed. And then they sacked Rome... There's these great reenactment groups there, like the Renaissance Fair people, but the Roman equivalent of that, who showed up and sacked Rome. And then there was a performance after by this group, My Barbarian, who's another group I want to talk about. And you can see how bad these pictures are, too, which I think is also part of the spirit of the project. You can tell, and I think it's been an interesting discussion, like from some of the, from Stuart's conversation earlier this morning, the quality of the documentation, I think, is directly proportional to the significance of the event in terms of the significance of the event in terms of a personal experience you would have being there. So you can tell the pictures were taken as an afterthought, like, oh yeah, I got to take some pictures of this, as opposed to something that's been engineered for documentation. It's something that you're so caught up in the moment, you're like, oh yeah, and you're whipping your camera out maybe, and I know Mark's like that all the time. So I love how bad the pictures are. And also My Barbarian's pictures are usually pretty bad too sometimes, but they're having more formal portraits too. But My Barbarian's this great performance group that's also part of this very tight-knit community. In this case, they did a project called Gods of Canada. And what I love about their work is that they will summon up the stories, the spirit, the folklore of whatever city they're going to, whatever building they're in, and they'll create a new project, a new story or narrative built entirely out of that. So for Gods of Canada, they each assigned themselves a god of Canada that was somehow connected to a Southern California story. So you can see the bear, the bear flag, California, and the legalization of marijuana. So they go into this deep research about a place and then create these performances and events that are somehow in conversation with the people that are living there and not artists necessarily. Like, there's a lot of confused people on the street here who have no idea what they're experiencing. And I think that's their target audience, really, that experience of having a conversation with people that are living in a place that they want to have a conversation with in some way. Which leads me to the salons that I've been having in my geodesic dome for, I guess, 5 years when I first moved there. And My Barbarian did one of the first performances there in 2002, one of their first kind of really complicated site-specific projects. So they visited the dome, and then it took them a year to kind of figure out what they wanted to do, but they wrote this morality play, I guess, that went on for about 6 hours, called Night Marathon Extravaganza, that took place over the course of the sunset. So this is the home, the geodesic dome in the garden. So when I first moved in, I started just this series of events, just inviting people from this kind of community that I described to do things there. And that became like knitting events, one called Knit Knit, where everyone just hung out and made things all day. More conventional kind of literary salons where local writers would read, or one for kids. We had a mud pit for that one, for example. But these events that were focused on very particular communities, but also, so is this meeting. So for the knitting one, it's all the knitting freaks that came out, and then other local kind of regular salon people. So each event was kind of one day of like this focused activity where there was no product necessarily that came out of it. In this case, it was just hair and makeup and fashion, or this group Lesbians to the Rescue, LTTR, did one day of events, or a Yon family, and some, Nina and Maria are here, that's Nina. They came, and I think what was interesting about the events, it started out as very local, geographic, like my neighborhood or my community is about geography, and then I realized as the events evolved, my community was more about this network of people thinking about similar things. So Yon family heard about it through a friend, and they got in touch with me when they were in town from London and did this event. So they showed up at my door. I had never met them. We had just emailed, and they stayed over for a whole weekend doing this project. And it was this, in this case, we were embroidering messages to each other on our clothes all evening. Or one of the last events was this dancing convention. I'm going to buzz through this quickly because I know time's running out, which leads me to the schoolhouse, which is the series of workshops and activities we do in the house. I guess maybe I'll explain just quickly the video that you saw as you came in. It was called Dancing 9 to 5. That was produced by the Whitney Museum last year at their space in Altria, Midtown Manhattan. So for that day, I invited all these dancers in New York to offer free workshops of movement and dance to people on the street. And you could sign up. There was a whole schedule. You could come in, and there was like really advanced classes for professional dancers. And then there was like office workers could come and do really simple ones. This was the easiest one, just walking back and forth for an hour. And this is my aunt from New Jersey. That's the only one she felt comfortable with. But I like the idea that, you know, just as this is as an example of what I was talking about, like the idea that there was this space for one day from this very regimented work period from 9 to 5 that anyone could come in from an office worker to professional dancer and have this experience with movement. I'm going to skip these because I want to have quite time for like maybe some questions after. I'm going to finish with just some parades that I've been doing lately, which is weird because I actually don't even like parades that much, but I'm really interested in the idea of parades as temporarily occupying our city. In this case, this is called This River Is Our Parade. This was at Valencia, California, CalArts. So I work with students to develop this one day where we created this event along the river. It's one of the ten most endangered rivers in the United States and the only remaining natural riverbed in Southern California, but nobody in Valencia is aware of that. So we kind of thought of this as like a pep rally for the river, and there was a series of events. No budget, no intense like planning. It was whoever showed up, whoever happened by. So I'm very active with my website. So I post this well in advance, and the whole story of it was there. So I had this environmentalist get in touch with me who saw it on the website, this woman with the sign, Honk If You Love Frogs. So she saw that we were doing a parade in the river, and she got in touch like, oh, I'm so excited. I've got frog costumes, I've got signs, what do you want? I'll show up. And I love the idea that
We had random suburbanites walking by. We had radical environmentalists. We had lesbian performance troupes. We had this meeting of all these people. And it was just this kind of sad little river that we all shared, that some people didn't know it was there and others that did. But for that one day, we're just kind of walking along. And it was kind of an inverse parade where the audience processed in the projects you kind of happened upon them in a way. And then the termination point was under a freeway overpass. So this place that's typically junk, perhaps you could even say the least valuable space in the entire city of Valencia, this is where you would expect to find bums probably or whatever, was reappropriated as this very sophisticated theater, almost like it was our little amphitheater. And for that one moment, I love how this underpass became like reclaimed as our you know, pretty effective performance space. And I guess maybe this is the last project. This was a parade that was just a few months ago for the Indianapolis Museum of Art called the East Meets West Interchange Overpass Parade. And this is the score. So this is the work, which is the score of movement, and it dictates how the parade's going to work, which basically says everyone from the east side of the United States gathers on the east side of the parade route, and everyone from the west side of the United States that's participating in the parade gathers on the west side, and then they're going to meet and collide over this freeway overpass, which in Indianapolis is perfect because they have the speedway there, the Indianapolis 500. So here's the map of the United States interstate freeway system, and you can see this line demarcates where these two teams of paraders are going to be coming from. So by your zip code, we could determine what side you're going to start in. And it divides Indiana in half. And then it divides Indianapolis in half. And actually, when this freeway was built, it really split the city in half and created a huge commotion, as is often the case, of really isolating one neighborhood from another. So for this one day, these two parades would march, meet, and kind of, well, I didn't really say what would happen when they meet. It was kind of a mess. They just kind of met up in the middle, and some straggled onto the other sides. But so I designed these two huge banners, the East Banner and the West Banner, and then every parader from one side posed for a portrait in front of their West Banner with an arrow pointing the direction they would be headed, and this is the East Banner. And I wanted it to be the specific material that would get really dirty as possible, so every mark of every person would be left on this material as evidence. And then these banners headed off the parades, heading one direction, heading the other. Some people didn't know there was another parade heading towards them, so when they met, some people were surprised. But the interesting thing was how it wasn't like war, like these two parades hitting each other and getting in a fight. It was more like, and this I didn't expect, it was more like each parade became the audience for the other parade and they waved at each other. Because if you're in a parade, you can't enjoy it or experience it. You don't know what happened in your parade. So each person in the parade had another parade to watch. And because there was very little attendance audience-wise on the freeway overpass, it was really nice on the overpass. Like, we had two parades of simultaneous audience members and praters. And then the banners were hung up in the gallery. All right, so lastly, this is just a little preview of what I'm thinking the next project will be next year. It's a garage project where, well, the idea is that pretty much every home in the United States has this space pointed towards the street with this huge piece of pavement in front of it where we supposedly keep our cars. A lot of people don't. Maybe we won't even have cars anymore in a few years, by choice or not. So what happens to this space? So the project is going to be to turn these garages into self-run retail spaces and community centers. So every person I work with could decide if they wanted to have a yoga studio or sell their homemade jam or sell yarn or have a massage parlor. So I want to do a series of these garages around the United States, each one being kind of like a model for how someone could reclaim their garage and reappropriate it in some way. Anyway, so that's it. Thanks. I think we have like 4 minutes left if anyone has a thought or a question or something. I don't know if they have a microphone.
That was fascinating. Thanks so much for that. I was just wondering about how contagious these projects are, like with the edible project and the front lawn. Did you find that when one front lawn was developed, more front lawns started to be developed in the same regions, and the same thing with the animal estates?
Well, my original fantasy for the gardens was that the garden on the street would, its most immediate impact would be on that street, when in fact I found it's the stories of the garden that's even as powerful, if not more so. So a lot of people never see any of these gardens, they just read about them, and the story of it becomes the most significant thing. So its impact is invisible to me. I get a lot of emails from people all over the place about it. And there have been immediate situations where in New Jersey, we did it in that afternoon. We were telling these neighbors, and that afternoon they went over and ripped up their lawn two doors down, like it was that immediate. But usually that's not the case. But I don't know, it'll be interesting to see. I found that the press is the most effective means for that, because I never send out a press release about the project. I never, you know, I just sent out a little email to my list, but I got picked up by blogs, so as, and then by different mainstream media. And what's interesting, when the mainstream media covers it, all of a sudden it's inserted itself into public dialogue. And that for me has been the most interesting part, and something that I was not thinking about or prepared for at all. And that I think has its own unique issues. But also, you know, making these radical, extreme, crazy gardens gives anyone else on the street license to do just anything less. You know, like, oh, well, I can put a few tomatoes out, you know, because that, they're doing that crazy stuff. So if I do this little thing, that's not such a big deal. But, oh, one thing I forgot to mention, I was thinking, like, this is being recorded, maybe, and going online. So I put the whole PowerPoint presentation online at fritzhaeg.com/freeze.htm. So if anyone's listening to this in the distant future, my disembodied voice talking to you as our civilization is collapsing and you still have internet, are you there? You can go to the PowerPoint presentation and listen to it, or, you know, see all the pictures. Anyone else? Stuart?
I know you're slightly wary of discussing how your work might fit into a kind of art history, but I am very interested in the way it links up with a lot of projects specifically in Los Angeles, in particular things like the Center for Land Use Interpretation, Jorge Pardo's house that he designed, because I think you were trained at the Rhode Island School of Design, as I recall.
What is that, Carnegie Mellon?
Oh, sorry, Carnegie Mellon.
Yeah.
But you studied as an architect or in design?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, there are a lot of trajectories coming into your work that don't necessarily have to do with conventional art history, but, I mean, you've already mentioned the way you sort of have a symbiotic relationship with art institutions, and then obviously you're taking things out of the gallery, but in a very different way than, say, the first generation of land artists would have taken it out of the gallery, which usually involved very large, empty spaces that were very far away. And I think the fact that you mentioned this idea of, you know, I mean, in terms of Le Corbusier and the idea of how do we bring the country and the city closer together somehow, but also in terms of manifest destiny, I mean, just somehow bridging nature and civilization, I guess, I mean, in the grandest terms.
Yeah. No, I'm really interested in those issues, and they're really hard to talk about, but I'm interested more and more in having those conversations, because I think they're important, especially when I talk to students, because I think we're trained so narrowly in particular disciplines, and I think we need deep training in particular disciplines. We need insular dialogues, like in the salons, in our art worlds, in our architecture worlds. We need to check in and talk to each other and have these conversations that aren't accessible to a larger audience. We need them, but then we need to step outside of them. Basically, whatever we did in that circle is meaningless unless we step outside of them and have a conversation with a larger public, I think. And I don't think everyone needs to do that, but I think we need places in our disciplines for people to step outside of them comfortably. So that's how I'm defending myself. But that's how I feel, like I'm hold on to the term art very loosely, because if someone were to say, well, like, is that art? I'm interested in the story of art that comes before it, but I'm not going to go to the mat trying to defend it as art. Because that's not my main battle, you know, with the work.
But then I guess a second question is in terms of the way the sundown salons in particular, you know, did generate communities, you know, by bringing other communities together. But I suppose many of the ways we've talked about publics in the past come out of an urban culture that's very European or perhaps East Coast in the United States. But your project, even in terms of addressing someone like Anna Halperin, for instance, it's about generating communities in isolated areas, which is what the West Coast was always considered to be. And now that it's becoming another model for a new kind of urbanism, I mean, where do you see culture and art fitting within those communities, within that kind of urbanism, which some would call a suburbanism?
Yeah, I mean, it's all about what's happening in the east side of L.A. right now. I think it's totally different from a New York and European model of a top-down system of large institutions that everyone is looking up to, and that's the focus of all of our cultural attention. And in a place like, you know, maybe Portland, east side of L.A., wherever else, it's more about a network of a lot of small individuals and groups independently doing things that are then in touch with each other so that we are our own institution, ourselves coming together. Not to say we don't need the larger institutions, but I think there's this like flowering of a real cultural diversity of room for all of these strata to exist simultaneously in each one playing a different role, because you can't exist at that like scrappy level forever. Like as work matures, it needs larger support and it needs different kinds of audiences. So they all, you know, it's like a healthy ecosystem. You have to have everything, and you have to, you know, back to the title, something for everything. I think we need to understand that whenever we talk about one way of operating or working, like myself, that doesn't preclude all others. You know what I mean? It's like just one of many. And I think I think that's one thing that's felt good about LA. Like, there's all this room to do all this stuff that nobody's rushing to identify or label, you know, and it can kind of gestate without a lot of that pressure for it to be immediately, you know, pinned down or compartmentalized in that way. So I think we're out of time, right? Okay, thanks.